This is the 12 Songs of Christmas. I'm Alex Rawls, and today I'm talking about a Dave Brubeck Christmas. In 1996, the jazz pianist released the album, and Kraft Records reissued it on CD and vinyl this holiday season. Since Brubeck died in 2012, he's not around to talk about it. But being a New Orleanian, I live in a city with a lot of great piano players. Today, I'm joined by Matt Lemler, a jazz pianist, arranger, composer, and professor at Loyola University. When I asked Facebook who in town could help me get a handle on Dave Brubeck, Matt was the clear favorite, and it was a good conversation. We'll get to it shortly, but I want to take a moment to shout out another Christmas musical friend. Last year, I interviewed Christmas music blogger Jim Goodwin, who runs ChristmasUnderground.com. I'll put a link to our episode in the show notes, but he's once again scouring Bandcamp for the best indie Christmas music, and if you want to update your Christmas music library, you should be following Jim and Christmas Underground. Through him, I found Atlanta's Lunar Vacation, who cover Nora Jones' Christmas Calling, parenthetically, Jolly Jones, on their new Christmas Baby Please Come Home EP. Let's check that out. If you only know Dave Brubeck from his signature track, Take Five, a Dave Brubeck Christmas will come as a bit of a surprise. In 1959, Brubeck's erudite, sophisticated jazz couldn't sound more collegiate if it came with a tweed jacket with elbow patches. It was an audience he actively cultivated, having recorded Jazz Goes to College in 1954 during concerts at Oberlin College, the University of Michigan, and University of Cincinnati. Matt and I talk about that period, but his work remained ambitious, serious, and often spiritual through the 70s. By the 90s, his trailblazing days were behind him, but you can hear him working smartly, but more modestly, often solo, as on a Dave Brubeck Christmas. We'll start with Take Five, the song that put Brubeck on the map. Then we'll pick it up on the other side with Matt Lemler on the 12 Songs of Christmas. So you're teaching at Loyola. How's the semester going so far?
The semester's going great, Alex. Thanks. Yeah. Every semester is always different. New kids, new students. Yeah. Things are good.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
You're about halfway through. You're past halfway through the semester. And so you now know who your students are, right?
Yes, as musically, I know all my students. Yes.
Well, actually, where I was going with that is, I mean, I teach as well, and the first few weeks into the first month is all kind of a honeymoon period, yep. And you look at them, and they all seem so promising, and then by the time you get to now, you've got pretty clear vision. You know who actually has promise, and who's going to collect a grade?
Yes, for the most part, but there's been some students in the past that have surprised me that I thought they were really going to have a struggle with music, and I was questioning to myself, you know, maybe they should consider possible another type of line of work, and I was surprised by one special student that. She worked very hard, and then by the end of the semester, like, her whole music had changed, and she had blossomed into like a really great, promising musician. So it really took me by surprise and changed my perspective of teaching, because you never know.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, there are kids or students that are talented right off the bat, and then they're either going to be heading in that right direction, or sometimes they just stop growing and they're talented the way they started school and they never progress. So yeah, it's always a different aspect. But it is true, when the semester starts, everybody's smiling, and then by after midterm, usually not many of them are smiling. The honeymoon phase is definitely over, and yeah, it's time to get to work. There's some students that are smiling and some students that aren't right now. So.
So before we get into talking about Dave Brubeck, I also wanted to talk about one of your recent projects. Last year you released Someday You'll Be Sorry, a tribute to Louis Armstrong.
Yes.
As a piano player, what about Armstrong made you feel like you wanted to do a tribute?
Well, as a piano player, and I also, I started singing as well, which I never did when I first started playing music. And so it wasn't until I was in my early 40s, late 30s, early 40s, that I started singing as well. And it was Louis Armstrong's voice that kind of attracted me to being trying to be a singer as well. And so Louis Armstrong is... to me, the epitome of everything that music is, that jazz music or music in general, popular music, rhythm and blues, gospel, all of it, it's Louis that kind of inspired all of us. I mean, I've always said, if there was no Louis Armstrong, we wouldn't have, I'm going to name names, but like Bing Crosby or Billie Holiday or Miles Davis or Dizzy Gillespie, from the amazing instrumentalist to the amazing vocalist. It's all Louis Armstrong, that all these Frank Sinatra, all these musicians and vocalists were inspired by Louis's voice, literally, not just his gravelly voice, but just his passion and knowledge and wisdom and everything that comes from being able to speak that language. Louis had it all. From New Orleans, it's also he's from here, so wow, that's amazing. And to drive by places, even to today, you know, I work at the Nopsey Hotel on Wednesdays and Fridays, and I drive past a couple of places that are historic New Orleans places that were the Eagle Saloon and the Little Gem Saloon and all those places that are right there on Porges, and is that O'Keefe or something like that, all those. The Karnofsky's pawn shop is still standing there, although it's not really labeled yet or anything made of it. But all these historic places are still there, and I can pass through these places. And wow, Louis Armstrong was there, Ken Olive was there. All these great Jelly Roll Morton, all these heroes of mine. 100 years later, they're still inspiring musicians and. And to honor Louis, I used two great New Orleans musicians that I have the utmost respect for, Don Vappy and Johnny Vodakovich. And we just did a trio in the studio one day. And the song I chose was Someday You'll Be Sorry. That was actually composed by Louis Armstrong.
I said, someday you'll be sorry.
Someday you'll be sorry.
Someday you'll be sorry.
Someday.
Someday you'll be sorry. Tears up to that to the suicide. Oh, yeah.
So we're here today to talk about the reissue of 1996's A Dave Brubeck Christmas, which was reissued earlier this Christmas, which was reissued in October. Now, for me, and a lot of people, I suspect, Dave Brubeck equals Take Five, the 1959 track in 5/4 that's one of the handful of jazz tracks that almost everybody knows, even if they don't know its name. Can you give me kind of the short version of what I need to know about Dave Brubeck besides Take Five?
Well, for one, a lot of people confuse Dave Brubeck as the composer for Take Five, and it was really written by his saxophonist, Paul Desmond, who's a great musician and great respect. He had respect for Louis Armstrong and Charlie Parker, these musicians before his time. And Dave Brubeck, I think the story is with that tune is Paul had this concept, and then Brubeck added that boom bop ba da boom bop boom bop, but that was Dave's contribution to that song. But what was your question? Was
just kind of give me give listeners a sort of a quick. Who's Dave Brubeck? What do we need to know?
Dave Brubeck was a jazz pianist composer, and he did write. Although he didn't write Take Five, he's that was his quartet that made that famous. There's other tunes that he wrote. One of my favorite tunes is In Your Own Sweet Way that actually Miles Davis covered as well. Also Blue Rondo a la Turk, which is on that same record as Take Five. It's a mixed metered song and Brubeck was a wonderful jazz musician. He started, or he was part of the Jazz Ambassadors with Louis Armstrong, which is a group that the government put together to spread democracy throughout the world, and they used jazz musicians as a means to spread jazz music, which was. During that time, I mean, a lot of, especially Russia and before that, Germany and some places in Europe, they did not like jazz music at all, and mainly because of the freedom of it. I mean, they were afraid it was going to cause democracy and cause revolution and all that stuff. Which in some ways I believe it really does. And so that was Brubeck was a wonderful pianist. I mean, he was steeped in the tradition of the jazz piano, and especially with this old school stuff, stride piano, which I've come to appreciate and started to focus on in the last 10 years of my music career, and to revisit this Christmas album that he did solo piano. It's so technical and so musical very hard for a pianist it's one of the hardest styles to play, and it's not really played that much anymore because it came out of a tradition of Art Tatum and Fats Waller in 1920s, James P. Johnson, all these great stride pianists. That was a means back then of pianists cutting their teeth and saying, okay, if you're a great pianist, you can play like this. So all these, they would have these so-called cutting contests back in the day where pianists would sit down at the piano and play, and then somebody else would sit down and play, and they'd play it faster, they'd play it more complex. And Art Tatum was, I know we're talking about Brubeck, but Art Tatum, sure. Was the, Art Tatum was the utmost, from what I got from hearing Oscar Peterson talk about Art Tatum, he was the one that would cut everybody and win those piano competitions, and he lived for that, from what I understand. Oh. So, but Brubeck was in that league as well, and in the quartet setting in those records he did, you don't really hear that much because he's playing with the drums and bass and sax. But when you hear this Christmas record and some other things Brubeck plays, I'm thoroughly amazed. Just listening to it again this morning before coming here, I know he was in his 80s or 90s or something when he recorded that. So he was up in age, and he still sounds like he's 20 years old playing. And you think, wow, the age of his fingers and just his back and his all the problems we have as we age. And some musicians kind of slow down, and he definitely was still still pumping it out, which was pretty amazing.
We're here to talk about the Dave Brubeck Christmas album. And as you mentioned a minute ago, you started talking about it being a stride album, solo piano. And I have to say, the version, the place where, I'm going to let you tell us about stride a little bit, but I thought it might be a little easier if we actually give listeners a something to work with here. So I hear it most obviously in Winter Wonderland. And so what I want to do is go ahead and play a little of that, and then we can sort of nail some of this thought down so we can make it sort of make this conversation a little more concrete.
There's only like there's maybe three or four pieces that are stride. The rest are just solo piano and his interpretations of those old Christmas hymns and songs.
Oh, okay.
You know, stride, I think of boom-chick, you know, the two hands you hear like the bass. So Winter Wonderland is definitely one for sure.
All right, here we go.
I like that song too.
Yeah. Actually, we're going to come back to, no, let's do stride right now because we're hearing it. I want to come back to that question about like liking the song. But so where do we hear stride in that?
So it's you hear it right from the beginning. He's playing basically, you know, if I could explain, it's hard to explain music, but without being on a piano or an instrument, but he's playing, you know, if you think of like a John Philip Sousa marching band or a band that plays marches. And you know, if you can go back and visualize yourself like in the late 1800s, which is probably impossible to visualize, but back then that was the music of the day, and these concert bands would play in the park. And so you'd have like the tuba at the bottom, and it would go on boom, 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 which is still today. You hear it in all the brass bands and so forth. That tradition is still there. But so you have the tuba or the baritone horns playing a bass note, and then the clarinets and French horns are kind of in the middle section. The trumpets and the flutes are at the top end of the section, Back at the same time as John Philip Sousa, there was an African-American composer named Scott Joplin who was known as the King of Ragtime. And Ragtime was basically the marching music put into piano form in a way. But with Scott Joplin, he's definitely using a lot of African influences and European influences where he's using different rhythms and things like that, the historians that I've read about, they said ragtime, that people would call it music, it sounded ragged to them, and so that's kind of how I think ragtime, that's how we believe how ragtime, the name came about. But because that music was so popular and it was in piano form and it was literally a classical music, there was no improvisation, it was all scored out, and so anybody that could read piano music, and back then in the 1800s and early 1900s, there was a lot of families, and most families had a piano in their home. Most everybody in the house learned piano. You have to think about, there was no radio back then, there was no records, there was no there was just sheet music and piano scores and things like that, and so a form of entertainment was through the piano, or a lot of, sometimes they had organs in their houses. And so you would have, you know, that was their form of entertainment. Families would gather around and play piano, and they would sing, and they would, you know, if I could imagine, probably singing hymns, probably playing Beethoven and Mozart and everything else. But Scott Joplin's music was in that repertoire as well, and it was very heavily in that repertoire. People were... it was a big craze. People loved the ragtime music. And it was so it was in the concert bands and also solo piano. Move forward about maybe 20 years or so later than that, you'd have musicians like New Orleans musicians Jelly Roll Morton or New York musicians like James B. Johnson. They would grab these ragtime pieces and then they would improvise on it, and they would also put their own spin and rhythmic aspects. They would do the Maple Leaf Rag, but you could hear it was Maple Leaf Rag, but they would make it their own. And that was, to me, from what I understand, probably the one of the starting points of how jazz music and improvisational music started through these ragtime pieces. And so you move forward to stride piano with players like Duke Ellington, Fats Waller, James B. Johnson, Jelly Roll Morton. They were putting their own spin, and also Dave Brubeck as well. They were putting their own spin on these Scott Joplin songs, but also New Orleans tunes and popular songs of the day. And same thing with Christmas songs or whatever. It's a way it kind of pays homage to these concert bands and pays homage to ragtime, but it's also, it has swing in it. It has a pulse. It has there's a pulse in the concert and the ragtime music, but it's not always the same. You don't have the bass going boom 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 and then boom, and then the right hand is playing the upbeat. So yeah, boom chink boom chink boom, chink, and you have like this kind of constant sound. It varies. The rhythmic aspect varies. And listening to that track "Winter Wonderland" with Brubeck, he's almost playing the entire piano at the same time. I mean, it's with two hands, and you know, you can hear he's playing like octave spreads, and so he's playing like at least two or three notes, maybe four notes in his right hand, and then he's playing two or three notes in his left hand at all times, and he's moving about the keyboard up and down the register of the keyboard. So he's really, like I said, it sounds like he's playing the entire keyboard, and it's a style that I admire, and I've always admired it. It was, it came later in life. I didn't appreciate that older style till when Hurricane Katrina and the failure of the federal levees that made me appreciate New Orleans music and keep that tradition alive. And so, although Brubeck's not from New Orleans, it is a tradition from Jelly Roll Morton and the jazz bands from the back in the day.
Yeah. In 2019, you released New Orleans in Stride, and this is a collection, two-disc collection of you doing playing stride piano, playing a lot of classics, and playing some New Orleans songs, some just standards. Were you already interested in slide, or was the process of recording this sort of part of your way of thinking through and applying some of the things you've been thinking about here and some of the things you're saying?
It was a way to, going back to your question about Louis Armstrong, it was a way to pay homage to Louis Armstrong as well. I mean, almost everything I do regarding stride piano, I think of Louis Armstrong. In my right hand, I'm thinking his trumpet playing. Huh. And when I'm singing, I think of his vocals from time to time. And it was a way, because all my previous records that I released, they were bigger productions. The first record I did was a tribute to Stevie Wonder's music with a large ensemble. It was like six horns and two vocalists and piano, bass, drums, and it was all orchestrated and arranged and rehearsed and a lot of other productions that I recorded and released were the same thing. They were very complex, multi musicians, big productions, and I took pride in presenting those types of ensembles and bands and kind of showing off my writing and arranging skills. And I remember that first record I did, I had Tracy Freeman, who was Harry Connick Jr.'s producer, and Tracy had said to me, "Why are you hiding behind the horns? Why are you hiding? You know, he literally wanted me to do a trio record with all that Stevie Wonder music that I had rearranged and reharmonized. And I was like, I wanted to feature the writing aspect, and I wanted to feature all the other musicians in the band and all the great artists that were recording that, those records with me. So it wasn't that 2019 release. That was literally probably the first record I did in almost 20 years of recording music under my name, that I finally released a solo record, and it really literally was a solo record. No other musicians were on it. So it was a way to present old New Orleans, old Stride music, and then also some modern music as well. But it was a way to feature my voice and my piano skills and playing as well, and my arranging as well. But all in just the piano and voice. So, so it was very exposed. I'm proud of that record, even though that was like 4 years ago. I'm always working on my voice and my piano playing, so both has improved drastically since then. So I'm hoping to release another record soon. I have a couple already recorded. I just need to find a release date and decide whether I'm going to print CDs again in the future. But.
A minute ago, we were talking about Rubeck's version of Winter Wonderland, and one of the things you said was that you liked the song. So first off, tell me about Winter Wonderland as a song. What do you like about it?
I like the lyrics. And I like singing it, and I like playing it. I like the chord progression, which is the movement of the chords in the song. I like the fact that the bridge changes keys, and it's very peppy, very very lively, and it's probably one of my favorite Christmas songs. I think it's pretty. I'm pretty sure it has a Louis Armstrong version. That's where I heard it. I think,
could be. I have about 7 or 8 Armstrong Christmas tracks, but I can only remember 2 or 3.
Yeah.
So I can't be sure on that one. It certainly would track.
That's one of my probably top, if I was to say probably top 5, top 10 Christmas songs. And when Christmas season hits again this year, I probably have to think, well, it's probably here already. But yeah, I usually start doing, I usually start doing Christmas songs, about holiday songs, pretty much at day after Thanksgiving. I'm not sure what the rules and regulations of playing holiday music, but usually after they play Charlie Brown's Christmas on TV, it's usually when I'm like, okay, it's time for.
Yeah, I think once you pass Black Friday, I think all bets are off. There are. I mean, we're recording on November 9th, and there are already at least a dozen radio stations across America that have already,
oh yeah,
in the last week, have started switching to all Christmas format.
Yeah, in the grocery stores and Sam's and Costco's, they've already had Christmas decorations out and Christmas trees and lights. And my wife loves playing Christmas music, and we've been having Christmas music going on for the last 2 weeks now. So, and
well, I just had a piece in Daily Beast a week or so ago on Cher's Christmas album, really using it though as a reason to get into why they released Christmas music in October. And essentially it's because that's when physical retailers still want it. And the fact is, like, Costco starts selling Christmas in August.
Yeah.
And basically, and kind of the argument is that right now, is that with the economy being what it is, that more and more people are starting to shop earlier and are spreading out their Christmas shopping. And so you do have people who are buying, shopping for Christmas as early as August. And certainly by October, a lot of people are already into it. So it there is a sort of a very mechanical quality to why does this happen. It all feels like it all feels so wrong when there's still, in some cases, Halloween and certainly Thanksgiving still in the shoe. But at the same time, most of us aren't just starting our Christmas shopping after Thanksgiving.
Yeah, so. I'm like that. I'm very traditional. And same thing with king cakes. I won't have a king cake until it's king cake season. No,
there, I'm with you. Some things are sacred.
That is very sacred. That's a coffee roll right now, or a cinnamon roll.
Yeah.
Nope. No, you can't. No, it's not a king cake. Yeah. No, you can't put a baby inside that yet.
When Christmas season and the holiday season comes, I gather you start to play more Christmas songs as a part of whenever you're playing.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I have quite an extensive list of Christmas and holiday music, and yeah, and one stuff that is kind of affiliated with Christmas is Vince Guaraldi, who's another jazz pianist. Is Linus and Lucy, and I'll do that all throughout the year, and people love it, but that's kind of attributed to like Charlie Brown Christmas special and stuff. So I used to think of it as a Christmas tune, but now I just be like, I like playing it, and every time I play it, you can see people start dancing or put a smile on their face and stuff. Yeah. So, but I won't do Christmas Time Is Here until after Thanksgiving, unless somebody requests it, and myself included, I'm constantly, if I'm working with the trio or the musicians, and I call Linus and Lucy, just in fact a couple of weeks ago we did it, and one of the musicians in the trio said that's what got him into jazz, got him to play music, and he's a drummer, and he heard that Charlie Brown music. And same with myself. I mean, it was one of the things that was on TV at the time.
Yeah, there's no question that for generations, it was the first jazz they heard.
And Dave Brubeck too. Same thing. I think the Take Five was because it was so popular and played on the radio that got people into jazz.
Yeah.
But you know.
Absolutely.
And when that was released, it was playing on all the radio stations and something that people were not really exposed to.
I want to go back to the album because I love this version of Silent Night. And I kind of want you to help talk me through what he's doing, because with his right, it's clear he's playing the melody, but he's doing something with his left hand that I think is really interesting, but I'm not positive what it is. So let's hear that, and then we'll come back on the other side.
That's beautiful. I was just thinking how brilliant it was for him to incorporate Silent Night with his right hand and then incorporate Practice and Scales in his left. That's basically it's basically just a scale. I don't know what scale it is. I had to sit at the piano, but it's basically a scale in that key, and that's literally what's happening.
Yeah, I found that really fascinating because what he's doing with the right hand gives the piece a very static feel as he just keeps repeating the scale while the melody's moving on the left. And so...
It was absolutely the other way around.
The other way around. Yep, you're right. Sorry.
You're talking in a mirror.
Yeah.
But, unless he could be doing it, unless he's got his hands crossed, and he might be doing it because that would be my technique. My right hand is stronger than my left, so I'd probably move my hands crossed.
But the way what he's doing with his left makes the song feel static, and it sort of while the melody is trying to make the song move, but it's also being high enough that the left hand is so much louder.
Mm-hmm.
That it's almost like it took me a minute to find the melody, period.
Yeah, I agree.
And I thought that was very cool.
Very hypnotic, very repetitive with the left hand, and you kind of get it. The scale's not simple, but it's definitely something that most musicians practice as their daily regimen, or when they were younger musicians. I mean, practicing scales and modes and all these things, and to just play it over and over again, it even just that, and he sounds so good, and the recording sounds so good, that just that piano sound is just hypnotic, just with that scale line going from bottom to top. And I agree, the right hand is kind of just sneaks in there with the melody, and you almost don't hear it for a minute, and I think it's intentionally. I think he just kind of wanted to just kind of like sneak it in there, and then eventually you start going, oh my goodness, he's playing Silent Night.
Yeah.
You know, because you kind of get hypnotized with that left hand scale pattern going up the keyboard. So, yeah, it's pretty nice.
Are there Christmas songs that offer you as a pianist more opportunities, or ones where you hear, I know what to do with this one? Or there's one where, like, every time you play a song, you're like, I can hear 10 directions to go right now from this song.
There's certainly many unlimited ways to play Christmas songs, any music. And I can't answer that question directly because it's just it's a challenge. Some of these Christmas songs are so ingrained in my head that I hear them a certain way, and that's the way it is. But as a composer and as an arranger and as a jazz pianist, jazz musician, it's kind of my duty to like tweak it or change it and try to change it. So listening to this Brubeck record, it's amazing because he's stuff I hear he's doing on Silent Night or What Child Is This or O Tannenbaum and all that stuff. He's doing harmonic stuff that I would never even thought of, and I'm sure if we listened to another jazz pianist version of it, that'd be the same thing. And so I think not only just Christmas music, just music in general with creative musicians, there's certainly unlimited. It's just, you know, up to your imagination and how you want to do it. And that's why I thought that Silent Night was so brilliant, because he's kind of changed it already, not harmonic wise, but just the fact that he put that scalar movement in there as well to kind of mesmerize you for a minute and snuck in the melody on top. And as me being a player, sometimes that happens just in a live setting where I don't even plan it. Like, I'll just do it, and then I just, I can put this here. And so he may have created that on the spot, or maybe he worked on these songs in advance, or maybe he had been playing them for all these years. But if I was to just guess in the Brubeck's brain and intention, I would think if I was doing a solo Christmas record, I definitely want to kind of make it my own in some aspects and have it different than Vince Guaraldi or you know, there'd be no way I would record a solo piano record and do it exactly the way Vince Guaraldi did it or Dave Brubeck or anybody. I would try to make it my own in some way.
Yeah.
And so,
you know, talking about all the possible ways to play a song, one of the things I thought interesting on this is that clearly, Brubeck not only had more than one way to play Jingle Bells, but he couldn't decide which one was the one he wanted, and so he actually does two. There is the Farewell Jingle Bells, which is kind of the end of the night, slow down. There's a good chance somebody's probably sort of in their feelings at that point. But the album opens with Homecoming Jingle Bells. And maybe because that's when a little less expected, I wanted to start there. So let's hear a little bit about that, and then let's talk about it.
Okay. So he's doing this left hand trick. He's playing now. He's playing the melody in his left hand, and he's playing kind of like the bells, ching 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 ching. He's doing that in the right hand, and so he's actually it sounds like sleigh bells. Just a little bit we heard, you know, it's got that sleigh bell effect, but also towards the end of what we just listened to, he's voiced these chords in just a beautiful way. I mean, it makes me want to go back and transcribe, see some of the harmonies he's using there. So it's not the traditional harmony that's going on towards the end of that the phrase. So it makes it even more unique. So,
yeah, I was thinking that bell quality on the right hand. I was also the way it was sort of echoing with or sort of syncing up with notes from the melody, so that you had a kind of an echoing quality or a ring, or you literally got a ringing quality, yeah, as the two sort of work together. And if am I hearing that right? That sounds like it's all to the right of middle C.
The right hand is. The right hand's.
I mean, the right hand definitely, but is the left hand? Could you hear? Could you tell? Or could you hear that? That the whole thing was so sort of upper register, yeah, that it felt like he would be sort of all over here.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah,
I'd have to sit at a piano to find where that. Some musicians have perfect pitch and they could tell you, but I want to say he's kind of in the melody in his left hand is in the mid range.
Yeah,
whether it's exactly above middle C or below, it's close to middle C.
Okay,
and for sure, and then his right hand is up a couple of octaves in the higher register of the piano to give that bell quality.
Yeah, I thought that was also so interesting to hear after Winter Wonder or after Silent Night, where he's switching which hand is carrying the melody.
Mm-hmm.
When you're playing, is it more common that it's going to be because the right hand is in higher notes that the melody is more likely to be on the right, and that?
Most of the time, yeah. The for pianists, the melody is usually played with the right hand, and then the left hand is usually playing bass notes and chord tones, and then you can also add chord tones in your right hand. But traditionally, the melody is usually on the right hand, and in the upper register. But sometimes, as you know, classical pieces and different things of arranging for the piano, you can have the melody in the left hand, and then the right hand is playing, but it's in the left hand. It's mostly in the bass section of the piano, and it just depends.
Yeah, is that hard to do, to switch that to when you're used to having, so as you say, used to chording and playing bass notes on the left? Is it tough to suddenly to basically be chording with your right and playing lead with your with the melody with your left?
I think with Brubeck, I don't think it was difficult at all. I mean, especially with his skill as a stride pianist, and you know, you got to remember, if he's playing stride piano, he's playing bass lines and guitar chords or so forth as a rhythm, and is just in his left hand. He's doing so much work with his left hand. You know, he's doing boom chink boom chink boom chink, all with one hand, and then the right hand is usually soloing on top of it or playing other things. And so, I don't think it was difficult for him. But especially the Jingle Bell line, I mean, that's pretty standard Christmas fare, and it's not a very difficult line. But
so far, I've kind of been driving and picking the songs, As we get to our get close to the finish here, is there a song that you particularly were interested in, or that you'd that we ought to? You think we ought to make sure we pay attention
well,
to?
Well, I listened to it again this morning. I think it was "O Little Town of Bethlehem" caught my ear this morning. Also, I think is it "O Tannenbaum" or
yes, I got both of them here. Which one would you like
sorry,
to hear?
Not "O Tannenbaum." Greensleeves, the what child
yes.
is this?
Well,
that
yes.
was the one that the harmonic aspect. I really, really, really dug
right.
what he was doing.
In that case, let's go there and we'll talk about that to bring this conversation to a close. So hang on. That's great.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's also kind of scary, you know?
Yeah, it's a nice dark version.
A dark version. So you're thinking about what child is this, I guess. whose child is this?
Exactly. It's an open question on this one. You know, one thing I was thinking about was that before we get, I want to get into the what drew you to it, but I was also thinking about how percussive it sounded. That I don't know if it sounded like, was that in the way he played it, or is that in the way that it was mic'd and produced, do you think?
I think it's in the way he played it. Those chords are called, sharp nine chords, alternate chords, altered chords. And there's what I usually call it, like it's a rub, like it's rubbing against the harmony, and it's a harsh rub. It's not a smooth rub, you know, it's no oil. It's definitely causing a rash.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
in your ears in some ways. But as a pianist, for me as a pianist and I can't critique any of this music in any sense other than the fact that I appreciate it, and I appreciate the fact that we were talking about how can you make this your own, or how many types of versions can you play this, and he definitely that one caught my ear and attention, and still does. Just re-listen it again, and it's just like it's almost like Scriabin or Stravinsky or something. It's like, you know, they knew what they were doing, but it was they could also create intensity, and so it's not I don't think it's a miking issue. It's just definitely a composer and arranger's kind of intent to, like, I'm going to create this rub here. I'm going to create some dissonance, and with this beautiful melody, it is such a beautiful melody. I mean, I can't remember the first time I heard it, but it seems like it's always been with me.
Thanks to Matt Lemler for the time and the talk. You can find Matt online at mattlemler.com. You can find A Dave Brubeck Christmas wherever you buy music. You can find me at 12songsofchristmas.com and on Facebook at 12 Songs of Christmas. Let's wrap up with one more from Matt Lemler. We talked at length in the show about stride piano and mentioned Lemler's album New Orleans in Stride, Volumes 1 and 2. We'll finish with a song from it. This is The Song Is Ended. Talk to you next week.